Meet Natural Cycles, the only FDA-cleared and CE-marked birth control app that's 100% natural, hormone-free, and side-effect-free. Here's how it works. The app analyzes daily changes in your body temperature to find your fertile window, so you can plan or prevent pregnancy naturally. Natural Cycles is a clinically proven, non-hormonal birth control option that's 93% effective with typical use and 98% effective with perfect use. No synthetic hormones, just science. And if you're ready to start family planning, switching from preventing to planning a pregnancy is as easy as tapping a button. Plus, the Natural Cycles app makes tracking fertility easy. You can measure your temperature trends using an Oura Ring, Apple Watch, or our Bluetooth thermometer, which is free when you sign up for an annual subscription. Join over 4 million registered users who are taking control of their fertility naturally. Save 15% when you sign up with code RADIO15 at naturalcycles.com. That's Radio 15 for 15% off today.
Out here, it's not only the amazing views, but the way time stretches out a little longer and how the breeze hits just right at the summit. With AllTrails, you can discover nature's best with over 450,000 trails around the world. Download the free app today.
Only at True North stores, new True Rewards members stack your savings at the pump. Sign up and earn 15 cents a gallon on your first fill-up. Second fill, get 30 cents off a gallon. Then earn a massive 40 cents off a gallon on your third fill-up. Join now. This offer won't last. Find the True Rewards app in your favorite app store. Download and click the star to sign up. Must be a new member of both True Rewards and Shell Fuel Rewards to qualify. Limit 20 gallons per fill. Additional terms apply. Offer ends August 3rd. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Our guest this hour on the Okunard Jewelers Talking Text Line is Colin Thomas Jensen, who was previously the National Security Advisor to the USAID Administrator. He is now the Director of Impact at the Aurora Humanitarian Initiative, and he joins us on the line right now. Colin, thank you so much for making the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ian. I'm really happy to speak to you.
Are you overseas right now? I understand there was some confusion about how we were going to get you on the air.
Yeah, I'm actually right now in Yerevan, which is the capital of Armenia. The organization I work for was founded by Armenians and Armenian Americans to remember the Armenian genocide and try to support humanitarians who are working today to save people's lives in conflict zones.
God's work. Well, I imagine it's an awkward time of day there. We'll try and not keep you up too late. Many of these, these clean water and sanitation projects that we're talking about today that will not be completed, or at least not by USAID, they were almost done. So a lot of these supplies are just kind of sitting around on the ground, rotting, rusting. How does it feel for you to know that the U.S. government walked away in the middle of these jobs?
Well, it's devastating. First and foremost, for the beneficiaries of this assistance, there is no cavalry coming to pick up what USAID and the U.S. government dropped. By virtue, really, of the way in which the administration went about it, they issued a stop work order, which effectively demanded that any organization that was receiving U.S. government dollars immediately stop what they were doing. So if they were, for example, digging a well in a village that doesn't have water or doesn't have access to clean water, and they were, 2 inches away from hitting that aquifer to bring water to thousands of people, they had to put the drill down and report that they had stopped. And in most cases, that is exactly what happened. And we're seeing now stories of U.S. assistance, whether it's food assistance or other commodities that were going to humanitarian crises, being burned. There's a report that $600,000 worth of food is going to be set on fire and destroyed because it has gone stale and would not be healthy to deliver, simply because the decision to do reforms was made, but the way in which it was done was extremely crass and cruel, in my opinion.
What are the health consequences of leaving these projects incomplete? What does this look like for people in those communities, in those countries?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at this, two big consequences. At USAID, which was, when I was there, a $40 billion a year aid agency, almost 75% of that funding went toward either public health projects, which essentially is helping to eliminate infectious disease, helping to track pandemics or breakouts of diseases that might eventually make it to the United States. I think the big program that is most well known, I think, was the program that George W. Bush launched in the early 2000s to combat the AIDS epidemic in Africa. Mm-hmm. It's estimated that program has saved 25 million lives. So there's public health, and then there's humanitarian assistance. And this is the kind of water and sanitation projects that you're talking about. This is food assistance to people who don't have access to food. This is nutritional support to women, children who are starving and don't have enough nutrition to make it through the day. And so it's, you know, the effects are kind of in two different ways. With the public health side, I think we're seeing now estimates that a very credible medical journal called The Lancet published a report recently that suggests that as many as 14 million people could die as a direct or indirect result of USAID's evisceration by 2030, and that 4.5 million of those will likely be children under 10. That's simply as a result of, you know, if we cut assistance, if we're not providing mosquito nets, if we're not providing for malaria prevention, if we're not providing antiretroviral drugs for AIDS to suppress the AIDS virus, or the HIV virus, and prevent full-blown AIDS and the spread of that pandemic, if we are stepping away from seriously infectious diseases like polio and tuberculosis, that will certainly spread faster and kill more people as a result of this drop in assistance. That's one thing. And then second, in the humanitarian space, you know, these are places that are already on the knife's edge. Most often places like Sudan, like Eastern Congo, like Somalia, places where, you know, people are already living in a conflict zone, under duress, are often displaced from their homes, don't have access to food, don't have access to clean water. Gaza, of course, being the most public example of that today. You know, these places are not now receiving the assistance that they might have received had the U.S. government continued to provide it. And as I said, there's no one stepping in to fill that gap in any significant way at this point. And so, you know, more people will die of starvation. And we already know, you know, certainly from the reporting of journalists that, you know, that to suggest, as the U.S. government has, that no one's dying right now is patently false.
Thank you, Colin. I have a very diverse audience on this program, you know, to include people mm-hmm. who are hearing this and are thinking about, oh, God, what have we done? How can we help? This is awful. And then also some people that are, you know, I'm not trying to insult anybody here, but people that might be a little more cynical and that are just saying, hey, man, sure, we don't have that money, or we should be spending that money on Americans who need help. But it's not just about the money, and it's not just about the health outcomes for these communities.
Correct.
I would love for you to explain, money aside, health considerations aside, how does America turning our backs on these communities make Americans less safe?
Sure. One is one I alluded to just now, just the, you know, the programs that were helping our government monitor the spread of infectious disease overseas, the likelihood that somebody who contracts, say, the Ebola virus in Africa, the likelihood that they will slip through the screening because the screening is either depleted or non-existent and make it onto an airplane, come to the United States and infect someone here, as happened with the outbreak in 2014, I think that's more likely. And especially with, it's not just Ebola, it's a number of diseases like tuberculosis and polio that are highly infectious, that can spread quickly. The Marburg virus, you know, we had experts in the field, you know, patriotic Americans with scientific knowledge and understanding who could have gone and been doctors and made a lot more money, but instead chose to devote their lives and their careers to public service. Those people are now out of job, you know, in addition to the impact that these cuts have had on on people overseas. It's also you know, ordinary Americans who've lost their jobs, who've had to switch careers, who are also suffering as a result of this. Mm-hmm. I think second, and this really goes back to why USAID exists, USAID was founded by John F. Kennedy in the 1960s at the heart of the Cold War. And at that announcement, you know, when he announced the founding of the organization, of the agency, you know, he made a couple of big points. One, he made the moral case. And I understand, certainly, if people feel like we don't have a responsibility as America to be the world's doctor, the world's health provider. I understand that sentiment. But the second point that he made, which I think speaks to what you're asking about, is that our benevolence overseas, the United States being seen as a protector, as a country that would be there in times of crisis, that was there to help, even at a time when we might have been doing other things in the world during the Cold War that might not have been seen as so benevolent, that was a value in and of itself, because it demonstrated the compassion of the United States. And in comparison with other countries, the Soviet Union at the time, and certainly now China, that our motivations for providing that assistance was really built around wanting to do good in the world, but also wanting to advance American interests, to build strong relationships with governments, to be seen as a trusted actor who cared about other countries' citizens in the same way that we care about our own. And we're willing to, you know, put U.S. dollars, and it must be said, not a significant amount mm-hmm. of dollars, $40 billion. I'm not saying that's not a lot of money, but that's less than 1% of the federal budget. The willingness, the actions that we were taking overseas were a part of demonstrating that the United States stood for something in the world and stood against the values that, again, the Soviet Union and now China stand for.
Yeah, it sounds like Colin is talking about soft power. You know, when we say America is the most powerful, richest country in the world, we not only mean, you know, we will come bomb you to smithereens and roll tanks through the streets if we feel like we need to do that, but also, you know, it's not charity. It's we will enter into a partnership with you. We will make sure that you have medicines and rice and clean water, and we'll help you build desalinization plants and water treatment plants and airports and all sorts of other different things so that China or Russia does not beat us to the punch. And now, you know, they can use that leverage to turn you against American interests. And there's all sorts of different ways that can work against us. So I don't know why. You know, after 60 years of us being the sort of world leader, and, you know, nobody really wants to be world cop, but I don't think that's what we're doing here. You know, there's a difference between, you know, we're going to be the chief law enforcement agency for every country on the planet versus we are going to be the one that stabilizes these countries that otherwise will destabilize, that will hurt American interests at home and abroad. I'm just confounded. Like, Colin, this had such strong bipartisan support for so many years, and then it seemed like overnight it turned on a dime. How did that happen so fast?
You're asking a very political question. It's been pretty well documented that, you know, some of the biggest champions of foreign assistance over the years, and in the case of the current Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, a huge champion of foreign assistance programs that were in support of democracy and human rights. He's obviously been a huge champion of democracy in Latin America, mm-hmm. his stance on Venezuela, his stance on Cuba. To see someone like Marco Rubio flip so dramatically in such a short period of time, I mean, the explanation does seem to be a willingness to be subservient to the White House and mm-hmm. what the White House and this president want to do with foreign assistance. And I, you know, to your point about kind of showing up, and I can give a very concrete example. I've served on a number of overseas disaster response teams. One of those was in Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. And if you remember, that was a completely devastating quake, killed over 200,000 people. We were there on the ground within 24 hours, and within 48 hours, we had deployed two urban search and rescue teams. These are specially trained experts in rubble removal with sniffer dogs and the ability to scan an area quickly, find people under the rubble and pull them out. And I was on the ground when a team of firefighters from 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 Fairfax County in Virginia, pulled three American citizens out of the rubble of a hotel that had completely pancaked, five floors basically falling down on top of one another. Mm-hmm. And the resulting structure was the height of a one story building. We had a devastating earthquake pretty recently after USAID was, or really during the dismantling of the agency in Myanmar. And ironically and cruelly, the contract that USAID had with Fairfax County, with Los Angeles County, with Miami-Dade, the three fire companies that did this work, those contracts were terminated the day before the earthquake. And there was, you know, when China is showing up with an urban search and rescue team, when neighboring countries in the region are showing up with urban search and rescue teams, when European countries are showing up with urban search and rescue teams, we have no one on the ground. And that gets noticed. And it not only gets noticed, but it also costs lives.
Colin, I'd love to keep you around just about another 10 minutes. When we come back, I want to ask you more about what your organization is doing now to kind of fill in the gaps. And maybe let people know that are listening if there's anything that they can do. My guest is Colin Thomas Jensen. He's the Director of Communications, Advocacy and Impact at the Aurora Humanitarian Initiative. We'll hear more about what Aurora does right after this. If you want to shoot me a text, 504-260-1870.
Meet Natural Cycles, the only FDA-cleared and CE-marked birth control app that's 100% natural, hormone-free, and side-effect-free. Here's how it works. The app analyzes daily changes in your body temperature to find your fertile window so you can plan or prevent pregnancy naturally. Natural Cycles is a clinically proven non-hormonal birth control option that's 93% effective with typical use and 98% effective with perfect use. No synthetic hormones, just science. And if you're ready to start family planning, switching from preventing to planning a pregnancy is as easy as tapping a button. Plus, the Natural Cycles app makes tracking fertility easy. You can measure your temperature trends using an Oura Ring, Apple Watch, or our Bluetooth thermometer, which is free when you sign up for an annual subscription. Join over 4 million registered users who are taking control of their fertility naturally. Save 15% when you sign up with code RADIO15 at naturalcycles.com. That's RADIO15 for 15% off today.
Out here, it's not only the amazing views, but the way time stretches out a little longer. How laughter bellows louder among friends, and how the breeze hits just right at the summit. With All Trails, you can discover and experience the best of nature, with over 450,000 trails worldwide and navigation right at your fingertips. Find your outside with All Trails. Download the free app today and find your next outdoor adventure.
Escape the heat to True North convenience stores and get any size True Oasis fountain drink for 89 cents with True Rewards. Cool that thirst with any of your favorite Pepsi fountain drinks for 89 cents. As a free True Rewards member, pick the perfect size for you. No matter if you're craving a big drink or a small sip, it's just 89 cents. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
My guest is Colin Thomas Jensen from the Aurora Humanitarian Initiative. Colin, tell us about what your organization does and if there's anything specifically that you're doing or are able to do to kind of pick up where these projects were left off by USAID. I mean, is there any chance that these projects can be saved? Has too much damage been done? Is that part of your organization's mission?
I mean, it's certainly anyone who's in philanthropy right now is pretty intensely focused on how to fill the gaping hole of the loss of U.S. assistance. And I have to say, it's not just U.S. foreign assistance that's been decimated. A number of European countries, traditional partners of the United States and providing this assistance, and who really look to the United States to lead and look to us as an example of how to behave in the world, have also lowered their foreign aid budgets. So really across the board, this type of work has taken an enormous hit. The organization I work for now, Aurora, is focused on supporting grassroots local humanitarians around the world. USAID and other big donors traditionally will be supporting, with large checks, big UN agencies large international non-governmental organizations that provide humanitarian assistance. One of the things I experienced and one of my greatest frustrations at USAID, and I have to say, if your listeners have ever worked for any organization, if they worked for a grocery store, you know, they could probably find some inefficiencies and things they could do better. And USAID was certainly not immune from that. One of the things we as a government didn't do very well was fund these small local organizations that were in many ways the last mile of humanitarian assistance delivery, in many ways the most important actors. When you're trying to do more with less, as we are now as a global humanitarian community, one of the most effective ways to get assistance to people is to go directly to those individuals and organizations who are providing assistance on the ground. So we have an annual prize that we award to an outstanding individual humanitarian. It's a significant amount of money, $1 million. However, not it's a drop in the bucket globally, but it's a small organization. We do what we can. But what we also do is in the process of awarding that prize, we find and we surface, you know, extraordinary individuals who might not have ever had access to that kind of support, that kind of funding, and certainly that kind of funding without the strings attached that would necessarily come with a government grant. And so we have a network of about 110 humanitarians around the world. We have vetted them extensively and continue to do so to make sure that the money that we give them is, we can trust that they're going to spend the money in the way that told us they will. With this kind of trust and this kind of relationship with these local actors, we're able to, I think, make our contribution to this problem go a little bit further because we're imposing less work as a recipient of that aid on these folks. And at the same time, you know, working with them to provide other kinds of support that they may need to do the real work in the field.
I would like to pull in a couple text messages I'm getting from the audience.
Sure.
Here. Here's a text that says, "I only speak for myself, but as a taxpayer and a 100% disabled veteran, I spent 17 years in service, being medically retired before I hit my 20-year service mark. And I'd like to see our tax funding support veteran suicide and homelessness prior to mosquito nets, medication for AIDS, and feeding others. With all due respect, the U.S. needs to fill our own cups before we pour it out, helping others." Your response?
My response is I would like to see our government do that a lot better as well. Number one,
me
I think
too.
That, you know, I certainly throughout my career have worked very closely with men and women in uniform, even on the ground in conflict zones where they have a job and us humanitarians have a job. And I think some of my closest relationships and friendships over the years and professional relationships have been with military. So for your listener, I'd first say, you know, thank you for your service. And yes, I do think that our government should do it better. At the same time, I think that we can walk and chew gum.
I say that all the time. I always say exactly that. Walk and chew gum.
Yeah, we're
exactly right.
We are one of the wealthiest and most powerful countries in the world. You know, really the irony of the Elon Musk exercise of Doge, which was, you know, trying to root out waste, fraud, and abuse, which certainly exists in the U.S. government, was going after a small, relatively small government agency that supported folks overseas and has sadly a limited constituency here in this country, as opposed to going after the Pentagon. If you want to see waste, fraud, and abuse, I would like to introduce you to our Pentagon, where they spend billions and billions of dollars on white elephant projects, mm-hmm. on weapon systems that are no longer relevant, on projects that are, you know, without, you know, real merit scientifically or useful or utility on the battlefield. That's a place where certainly as a former U.S. government employee and someone, again, who has tremendous respect for the military and for the work that they do, I would love to see a much more efficient Pentagon and then allow some of that money to be spent in the ways that we were in the kind of work that we were doing at USAID.
Colin, I'm kind of running out of time here. I'm going to read one more text message before we wrap it up. Here's a text that says, "Hey, Ian, it's never going to end. We can build these people everything they need and show them how to grow rice, etc. But history shows it still won't matter. Their government, etc., will destroy it, and the people have nothing. We have to know when to say when. Your response, are these programs ineffective, as the texter says?
Well, I think that there's, that's a very cynical outlook, and I hope that I can maybe try to change his or her mind. I think, you know, what the United States has learned and other donors have learned over time is that, yes, these projects can be incredibly inefficient when they are implemented in countries with authoritarian and corrupt governments. Mm-hmm. And so really baked in 2024 and in 2025, but really no longer at USAID, but baked into the philosophy of providing assistance is, you know, if a country is corrupt, is poorly governed, we're not providing the kind of development support, the kind of economic growth support, the kind of big projects to support a government to help its citizens if the government's not helping its citizens. Where we step in situations like that is to provide immediate, you know, humanitarian assistance to meet immediate human needs, to prevent death by starvation, death by infectious disease. And so while I certainly do agree that, you know, in many situations, there has been a lot over the years, and certainly, instances while I was in the U.S. government where, you know, that money could have been better spent or might not have been as well spent as it could have because the governments that we were working with were not necessarily acting in good faith. But that to me doesn't mean that we kneecap the entire enterprise, particularly because I do think there's a moral argument for not allowing people to starve to death. But second, for what we were talking about earlier, that this really is soft power, and in removing that as a tool in the foreign policy toolkit, and I think really anyone at the State Department, anyone at the Defense Department will tell you this, in removing that tool with a machete, we have really handicapped our ability to be influential on the things like promoting good governance, promoting accountability, ending corruption that would make those foreign assistance dollars go a lot further.
Colin, we have to stop here, but I could talk to you a lot longer. We'll have to do it another time. Just real quickly on your way out the door, how can people help as individuals? Just if there's one thing they can do today to help.
Well, most immediately, while the world is kind of picking up the pieces and figuring out how to reconstruct the architecture that has kind of girded humanitarian assistance and do things more efficiently, many, many organizations are facing a crisis of funding. And so I would encourage your listeners, the biggest thing you can do right now is give to credible humanitarian organizations, give to the International Committee of the Red Cross, give to Doctors Without Borders, give to the International Rescue Committee, give to the Aurora Prize. You can find us at auroraprize.com. And know that if you do a little research, if you put a little, thought into where that money's going, the people who receive it are going to spend it in good faith and do the best work that they possibly can do to keep people alive and advance human health.
Colin, I say it at the end of a lot of my interviews. I don't think I've ever meant it more. Thank you for your time, your work, and your way. We'll look forward to having you on again.
I appreciate it. Thanks very much, Ian.
When we come back, we'll read some of your text messages and phone calls. We'll get caught up with the news. I'm Ian Hoken for Scoot. Be right back after this.
Escape the heat to True North convenience stores and get any size True Oasis fountain drink for 89 cents with True Rewards. Cool that thirst with any of your favorite Pepsi fountain drinks for 89 cents. As a free True Rewards member, pick the perfect size for you. No matter if you're craving a big drink or a small sip, it's just 89 cents. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
A message from a former New Yorker, presented by StreetEasy.
We left Brooklyn Heights in 2021, and we miss it. We went from sharing a neighborhood with a few celebrities to sharing a neighborhood with my wife's parents.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, StreetEasy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. StreetEasy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
You Must Remember This is a podcast about the secret and forgotten histories of 20th century Hollywood. Listen to You Must Remember This on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.